Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two lovely sponsors to mention for you at the top of the show. One of them is Environments for Humans, longtime sponsor. They're promoting their online Craft CMS Summit. That's literally craftcmssummit.com. Tickets are $99. It's a one-day event, but save 20% with coupon code SHOPTALK. And one month is an online learning video platform with the simple premise, what if you could learn anything in 1 month? The URL for that is onemonth.com/shoptalk, which gives you a unique discount to their service. But for now, let's kick things off.
Another episode of the Shop Talk Show, the world's only podcast about sound effects and web design. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Coyer.
Hey, everybody. And with us this week, Mr. Eric Meyer. Hey, Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
we didn't warn you that there's sound effects, but there literally are sound effects.
This feels like a Hallmark episode. I'm feeling good. This is good. You got Eric in the studio. It's wonderful.
Uh-huh. There were trumpets.
I brought in a whole Mexican mariachi band. They're all here. Say hi, guys.
Wow, awesome.
Eric is a lot of us think of him as a big industry figure, the CSS guy, as it were, the CSS guy. Long before I was just, you know, browsing around meyerweb.com and reading old stuff and new stuff. And Eric had 5 books about CSS published before I knew what CSS was. So that's a fact.
Youngin. Yeah. Noob.
I am a noob. I'm a noob in more ways than one. I've never built a table based website.
That's actually the really, at this stage of the game, it's kind of the fun thing in a way, because there was that, like, way back in the day when we were trying to tell people, don't design with tables. And they were saying, but tables work. And we were thinking, man, one day, someday in the far future, it'd be kind of awesome if we didn't have to have this argument anymore. And, like, eventually there will be people who we'll just, you know, we'll tell them how we used to build sites, and they'll look at us like we're crazy and say, why would anyone ever have submitted to that kind of craziness? And here we are. You're one of them.
We've arrived, and it's happening again. I heard Paul Boag was teaching his daughter some web layout stuff, and he just went right for Flexbox, because, like, yeah. why even bother with floats and all that old stuff?
Yeah, exactly. I can't wait.
I was going to say, I think now we don't complain about tables. We complain about floats. Oh, yeah. You're using floats. What are you?
Right. Floating elements like some kind of caveman. What is that about? Yeah, no, but that, I mean, right? We only ever used float for layout because Clear exists. Mm-hmm. If it hadn't been for Clear, we wouldn't have used floats either. We'd still be using tables. Or if there had been a Clear equivalent in positioning. Right. If there had been some way in positioning to say, push, you know, like position this below all the other position stuff, we never would have used floats. We just would have used positioning. But clear was it, right? You could drop things below other things. And now we've got Flexbox and hopefully soon grid layout. It sure looks like grid layout soon, where we can just leave all that stuff behind. Because floats are a hack. Because, you know, just like tables are a hack, they're a more elegant hack, but they're still a hack. And it'll be really nice to just, yeah, one day explain to the new designers, yeah, we used to use floats for layout. And they'll be like, what?
Really? You didn't use this thing that just you describe exactly where you want it to go and it goes there?
Yeah.
I've seen you give a talk about Flexbox and Grid in the not so long ago. So while we were in the same breath that we were talking about Eric having been writing about CSS since like the mid-90s, you're very much in tune with what's going on right now in CSS, and obviously.
Well, I try to be. That was actually a couple of years ago now, Chris, that I did that talk. If you can believe that, it's actually been a while. Because I have this tendency to do talks of, here's what's going to, like, CSS will be awesome in a couple of years. Like, I was doing that in the table design. I was, you know, like, we won't have to use tables anymore. We're going to use float, and we can do this stuff. And everyone will be like, that's great, but Netscape 4 doesn't support that. You know, and now we're, a couple of years ago, I was doing the Flexbox and Grid, and it's going to be awesome. And everyone's like, yeah, great. Nobody supports that. That's one of my things. But, like, I've been working on the fourth edition of CSS, The Definitive Guide. With Estelle Wheel as a co-author. And I'm having to get all up in this stuff again. And I'm just finished a chapter on colors, backgrounds, and gradients, which let me build a lot of really awesome figures in HTML and CSS and then screenshot them for the book, which was actually kind of fun. And basically my philosophy on that is, if I can make the figure do what I'm trying to explain, then I understand what I'm explaining. And if I can't, then maybe I need to go back and figure out, like, am I doing this wrong? Have I misunderstood something, et cetera? And there have been a few cases where, like, I'd written, like, you know, several paragraphs, and then I had some code, and I was sure that it would have, you know, such and so result. And then I built the figure, and it totally didn't have that result. And then I would, like, try it in other browsers, and it would have a consistent result that was totally not what I expected. And then I would have to tear out those paragraphs and figure out what was actually going on. So, if you really want to understand CSS, write a book. It'll only take a year or two of your life, and you won't make very much money at it. But, you know, there you go.
Nice to have.
Yeah, for anyone who's listening, writing technical books is just not a way to get rich or even really make a living. Sorry. The only people that I know of who can actually make a living at technical books are, well, the guy who wrote Windows for Dummies, he got rich, but he's sort of the Stephen King of the, right? But the people who make, who I know who have made a living at writing technical books are the ones who can knock out the teach yourself, you know, Excel 2009 in 24 hours. In like 24 days, and they do like four or five of those in a year, and then the advances form a decent yearly salary. But of course, if at any point, like, you can't land those contracts, or like all the release cycles fall apart or whatever, then it can be challenging. And of course, if you, like, for whatever reason can't write for 6 months, then that's 6 months of salary is just completely gone because you're not doing those books.
I wonder if the appeal is that you can do it while you're doing some other jobs sometimes.
The people I know who did it that way typically did not do anything else, except they just, like, for the next 2 months I'm writing, you know, teach yourself CSS in 24 hours. And for the next 2 months I'm writing, you know, Excel for Dummies, or, you know, not Excel for Dummies, because the people who wrote Excel for Dummies probably also made a lot of money. But, you know, they did, you know, master Excel in 21 days, and then for the next 2 months, right? So they do one of these every 2 or 3 months, and they just knock them out. And, you know, for people who enjoy that, that's awesome. But
you know, not to dwell on this too long, you must have found some value in it because you continue to do it.
Oh yeah, right? First there's the value of really understanding the whole thing, because I have to write about it and I have to explain it. And I can't explain it unless I understand it. There's the value. I mean, there's clearly the value of, like, professional profile, professional visibility. You know, it's like, oh man, I have your book on my shelf. Can you come to my company and do a thing? Or, man, I have that guy's book on my shelf, and he's speaking at this conference. I'm going to go to that conference. You know, that sort of thing. There is some utility in that. Although, honestly, having a really awesome blog is almost as much utility as anything else these days. If you, like, write really, like John Gruber, Daring Fireball, he writes really insightfully about Apple. So far as I know, he's never, like, published a book, and he rarely speaks at conferences, and yet he can make a living off that site because he writes really insightfully about that one thing. Well, not just about that one thing, but that's what he's known for.
So
publishers pay you. It's nice. It's, again, not something you can live on. I'm kind of a teacher by inclination. I like to share knowledge. I like, you know, like with my kids, you know, I love when they ask me questions about, like, you know, why is the sky blue? Is sort of that supposed to be that canonical, like, annoying kid question. I love that question, right? Why do the trees lose their leaves in the fall? Why did you do this way? How can I do this other thing? Like, I love that. I love to share knowledge. And when I don't, if I don't know, I just say, I don't know. Let's go find out. Let's figure it out together. And so that's like my whole career has kind of been either, this is what I know, here it is, I want to share it, or someone asked me a question, I'm like, I don't know, let's figure that out. So,
yeah, the proof's in the pudding there. I mean, if you look at all the writing and books and speaking and stuff you've done, it really has been a life of education.
Yeah, and the education does go both ways, right? Like I've written blog posts where I've said, hey, here's this thing that I found, and like, in the comments, people will say, well, here's what I found, or yeah, that's because of bug number, blah, 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 or whatever it is. And in other cases, I've written, here's how this works. And then people will say, yeah, no, sorry, that's not how that works. It actually works like this. I go, oh, okay. When I wrote the first edition of CSS, The Definitive Guide, the part that I still remember this, it was 2 weeks of email and almost crying at my computer trying to write the part on inline layout, like how lines of text and images are constructed, like how they're laid out. And I was emailing with Ian Hickson and David Barron. And like I would email, because I had sent them I think if I remember correctly, I had sent them the text for their review, and they were like, no. No.
Wow.
Completely really? No. Yeah. Once you really understand line layout, you gain sort of this sense of wonder that any web page ever renders at all. I'll be honest.
It does seem very weird, right? Because what we're talking about is like a line that breaks. So you write a sentence and there's not enough room for that sentence to render. So it moves down onto the next line. And we all know that's kind of weird, right? Because so if, let's say, you apply margin to it, well, that will push the, kind of the left and right, but it kind of ignores the top and bottom. But it does, you know, there's a lot of like weird rules that you just kind of get acquainted with over the years, but that's a little hard to explain, perhaps.
Yeah, and I mean the hardest part is just the simple. I have text, no images, no margins really. I have text of some mixed sizes in a few lines of flowed text, and I have a little bit of line height. That in itself, like I felt like there was blood coming out of my temples, trying to understand how it all like went together and worked. And this was this email back and forth to Dave and Ian where I would say, okay, I've got it now. It works like this. And they'd be like, no, you're closer, but no. And for two weeks, this went on. I do understand it now. At least I understand it as of a couple years ago. I have not yet written the part of the fourth edition that covers line layout. So that may have changed because a lot's been changing these last few years. And so we'll find out.
I hope that's one of those things that sticks around. At least I haven't heard any murmurs of changes in inline layout,
But I mean, that's the thing. How often do we think about it? Mm. Right? How often do we really think about line layout in general? We think about visual layout. We think about, where does this box go and how does that box flow and da-da-da. But we don't think about, how does this text get assembled? Because literally, I mean, just to give we could spend the entire hour with me just ranting about the Lovecraftian weirdness that is at the heart of the inline model. But like literally, the browser user agent has to look at every single character one at a time and figure out, okay, I've got this character. And I'm supposed to be using this font face. Do I have that character in that font face? And if I do, okay, I'll use it. And if I don't, I got to go to the next font in the font stack. And do I have that character in the next font in the font stack? And it like strings them all together. And if, let's just say like you have a big element, just to go old school, right? To make the text a little bit bigger. Then it's got to do the same thing, but it's got to scale it up. And then there's all this stuff. And then where does the line height get calculated from? And all the text like align to the baseline, depending on its values of vertical align, and how does that affect the spacing between lines of text, and this, that's just part of it. So,
yeah,
yeah,
vertical align factors in and yep, padding and stuff. It does. This has come up somewhat recently for me in that, you know, let's say you want like a headline that maybe even has some break tags in it, but you want to have it kind of look like a highlighter has gone over the line. So there's padding on when the line breaks down to the next line, that the padding that you've applied to this inline element kind of is on the second and third line as well. Whereas normally it kind of goes right against the left edge. That padding doesn't come down. And there's some kind of like, I forget what the new property is, but it's, you know, box decoration clone or something weird like that that affects it. Yeah.
Yeah, because we can do that now. It used to be that if you had a span element that had some background and padding and stuff, and it wrapped to multiple lines, you just had to picture it as though it were a box element that you just snapped off at each line break, right? Literally, just
yes.
And so that, like, if you had right padding, it wouldn't be applied to the right edge of that first line fragment because you snapped it in half. And now there's a property, and like you, I can't quite remember the name of it, where you can say, no, I want you to put the padding around every single one of these little inline flow boxes as though it's a little inline block.
Yeah, which is, so you're right. Know, it does this. Just earlier, I was like, this stuff never changes. And then we're like, oh, wait, it totally does.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Hey everyone, pardon the interruption. We're about to get into a long, interesting, personal conversation with Eric. And rather than interrupt that conversation in the middle to bring you our sponsors, just this week I thought we'd do the sponsors up front and do both of them and then just let that conversation play. So this week is brought to you by Environments for Humans and the Craft CMS Summit. That's craftcmssummit.com. Tickets for that are $99. It's an online conference that you can attend, you know, from anywhere in the world with a web browser, as we say. You can get 20% off that with coupon code SHOPTALK. The idea is it's a one-day conference all about Craft CMS, this widely beloved, anybody that uses it loves it, CMS system, you know, for managing your site, for building sites. So they have Brandon Kelly doing the State of Craft presentation. These are the people who work on Craft giving these talks. So it is right from the horse's mouth. So it's great for people that are already using Craft, but if you just want to level up your abilities in Craft, they have deep dives all day about things like component management, programming in Twig, getting to know singles, channels, structures, Craft plugins. This is your chance to get good at Craft. And then the end of the day has a wrap-up panel with the developers of Craft. So that should be pretty cool. That's craftcmssummit.com. It is also brought to you by 1Month. That's 1Month.com/shoptalk. 1Month is an online video learning platform with a simple premise. What if you could learn anything in 1 month? 1 month students learn to code by building real websites and apps, growth hacking their businesses and websites, and building payment systems and security solutions. So this is real. You're going to learn how to build a legit app with, and you pick the path you want to go down. You want to learn Ruby on Rails or Python. You want to focus on HTML and CSS. You want to build an iPhone app with Swift. You want to work on content marketing. They have courses on all of this stuff. And the pricing model has changed recently, and it's really beneficial to you. It's $49 a month for if you want to take one of those classes in a month. And that's 15 minutes a day. That's it all throughout the month. You know, if you set your mind to it and focus and think about something every day, you can get a ton done, and you absolutely can. If you sign up at 1month.com/shoptalk, you get 25% off that $49, so it's $37 or whatever, or $99 a month if you want access to all. If you want to just hit it hard and do all, you have access to all the classes at once, which is pretty darn cool. So in a month, you end up building a fully functional website in the style of like Pinterest, Instagram, or Yelp, depending on the kind of the path that you take. So. Yep, go to 1month.com/shoptalk, get 25% signing up from that, join 20,000 other students having success with this. So pretty cool. All right, on to our conversation with Eric.
So Event Apart is a thing that you founded. It's been around a long time, conferences and stuff.
Yeah, Jeffrey Zeltman and I co-founded back in 2005, so 10 years ago. We started small. And kind of grew, and now it's, we're proud of it. We're very proud of it, actually. It's
It has certain cities it returns to each year.
Yeah, we have certain cities that are favorites, like Seattle and Boston. Are like two that, well, we were just in Seattle. We're about to be in Boston next month, and we've also been coming back to them for almost the entire length of the show. And but there are other, you know, Austin, Texas is a relatively new addition.
Yeehaw!
And you know, we went in our first full year, which was 2006, when we were smaller, and then weren't there for a few years, but then we came back a few years ago. And yeah, you know, it's hard sometimes to talk about it because I like to try to talk about these things objectively, and I can't with this because we really are we're proud of it. It's, you know,
it's okay.
You know, 3 days of design, code, and content, and you know, all the basically we always try to have, you know, the best speakers, which is why both of you guys have been up there on that stage, telling the, you know, basically sharing with the audience like what to do now, like what the best practices are now or you know, imminent, and then also what's coming in the next couple of years. So that people can go away saying, okay, I've got stuff that I can like use to improve what I do now, but also I have some idea of what I'm going to be doing in a couple of years so I can be ready for it. And I think in some ways it's a very unique blend, and it's one that we work really hard to preserve. So, yeah.
I think when you said that it's been a number of years since you've done that layout talk, I think we were at I can't even remember that. It was in San Francisco somewhere though. It was like the official the W3 PEZA conference.
Okay, yeah.
Anyway, I think me and you were there together, and we met. I think for the first time for both of us, we met Tim Berners-Lee together. Remember that?
Yeah. Oh yeah, I remember
that. Wild. That was pretty wild. I had nothing to say to him, but you were, you know, not that I don't, but it just was awkward, but you had the perfect intro because you were at the time we're doing the Web Behind and kind of would have liked to get him on there. I'm not sure if that ever worked out or not, but at least that was something to talk about.
Yeah, it didn't work out for a variety of reasons. It was the sort of thing where he indicated that he was open to it. Mm-hmm. And so what I said to myself was I need to go, because this was spring of 2013. It was actually probably almost exactly 2 years ago now. And I was like, okay, I can't have Tim Berners-Lee on and ask him like the same question that every like person who doesn't understand the web asks. So I need to go and I need to sort of do some research. I need to do some stuff so that I can actually have this be worth both our time. Right, it would totally be worth my time, even if he just talked about what, you know, his groceries. just to talk to Tim Berners-Lee for an hour, that would be awesome. But yeah, I wanted it to be worth his time. I didn't want him to come away from it thinking, "Well, that was a waste." You know, that was boring. And then summer of 2013 came, and I stopped doing everything. So,
right. So we can get into as much into that as you want. It's related to your event apart. To talk designing for crisis, is that a good intro point for it, or how do you want?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, for people who are listening who don't know, in the late summer, August of 2013, our middle daughter Rebecca was discovered to have aggressive brain cancer while we were on vacation, and so in fact, it nearly killed her while we were on vacation. That's not something I've actually written about much, but the day she was life flighted to Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. If she hadn't been in a bay in an emergency room already waiting for a room because they were going to evaluate her, if she hadn't been there hooked up, she would have died that night. She never would have made it onto the life flight helicopter. She had to be stabilized in the ER with a crash cart. And that kicked off. I mean, we were at Children's Hospital in the pediatric intensive care unit for more than a week as they tried to first figure out what was going on, and then second, deal with it, which they did. Then we were in the pediatric oncology floor for a little more than a week. And then we came home for 2 weeks and then went back for 2 months back to Philadelphia from, we live in Cleveland. So we went back for 2 months of radiation and chemotherapy, which all went really well. I mean, it was in some ways it was kind of an adventure. because it was me and my wife and Rebecca and our other two children stayed here in Cleveland with my dad and my stepmom, who basically moved into our house for 2 months. And we dealt with that. And I just, I mean, I had to drop everything to focus on that. But where the talk comes out of, it actually starts with our experience that night as she was being life flighted, because I was trying to figure out what we should do. Like we were right. So we live in Cleveland. We were on vacation at the southern tip of New Jersey. Our daughter is medically comatose. She's been induced into a coma basically with paralytic drugs in order to keep her alive. She's on a life flight helicopter. We are not on the helicopter with her. I don't think that's even allowed. And even if it were, there wasn't room on the helicopter. They had 4 EMTs to monitor her because even with the drugs, no one was sure she would even survive that flight. And so we're being driven actually to Philadelphia at 10:30 at night, I think is when we left, maybe 11 at night. And I'm trying to figure out, like, what do we do when we get there? Like, and I know what the address is of the hospital, and the GPS in the car tells us how to get there. But then what do I do? And I couldn't find the answer online. Like I couldn't get that answer. And there was no path for people like us on the hospital website, which is, you know, not a unique problem to the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. I've been on a bunch of hospital websites and none of them even have, so far as I can tell, a path for people in our situation, let alone an obvious path. And this, Tim, you know, as I kept going through this process and seeing various design decisions, not just web design decisions, but design decisions in general, and good ones and bad ones, I started to realize that, you know, we're talking about a hospital where people come here probably every day in a panic because someone they love has been brought here by ambulance or by somebody else or whatever, or, you know, helicopter, whatever it is. Like, they got up that morning thinking that life was normal and, you know, today was going to be a regular Thursday or whatever it is. Have no clue that by the end of the day they would be rushing to, you know, a local hospital to see if their parent is okay or their spouse or whatever, right? And so
they're screaming, "Help me!" And they're not thinking how they normally think,
right? Because you can't. I mean, I will speak from personal experience. You almost can't think, right? Steve Krug said, "Don't make me think." There are situations where you almost can't, and right. So I hit up the website to try to get the information because I figure, you know, it's a hospital. They have an emergency room. They have, you know, urgent care. There's going to be something to tell me, you know, if you're coming here in a rush, like
where to go,
go in here, you're like, go in these doors, find these people, find this person, talk to them. And then they will tell you what to do next or whatever it is. Nothing like that. And I, you know, like I went through the website afterward and I couldn't even find a page that covered any more than one point of what we needed. Like every piece of information we needed was on a different page. It was all scattered around. And again, it's not just Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. It's not like they were, you know, they're behind the curve or uniquely bad at this. They're just like every other hospital website I've ever been on, basically, which is, you know, it's almost a brochure site. It's got a ton of information. It's got a, you know, it's great for people who are coming to the site sort of in you know, at their own leisure and to say, you know, I need to switch primary care doctors and it's annoying, but, you know, it's not something that's like immediately urgent. I'm going to look through the doctor directory, you know, the physician directory to see who's taking on new patients, you know, and that in itself might be certainly annoying. Don't get me wrong, but it's not, you know, holy crap, I have a drill bit stuck in my head, or, you know, or someone I know has a drill bit stuck in their head. What do I do next? And you might think to yourself, you know, you call 911, but not all of these situations is it a 911 situation. Like maybe I've already called 911. I know 911. I know that the ambulance is coming to get, you know, this person who's grievously injured my child fell down the stairs and broke their leg or something like that. And we've called 911, the ambulance is coming. But like, so I've already done that part and now I need to know what's next, right? What do I do next? What is the hospital going to, you know, like, expect? And there's nothing. And it's almost shocking when you put it that way. I mean, it still almost shocks me, and even though I'm completely used to it, just to say, wait, how have they not thought of this? But it's really a wider problem in design in general, where we don't think about stress cases. These are not edge cases. They're stress cases. Jared Spool gave me that term. And I think it's a really good one, where when you think about a user who's under stress and they're coming to your site, and you might think to yourself, nobody in stress would ever come to use my site, but you don't get to make that decision. Your user does. So if you have a site where, like, people can create accounts and post data about themselves. I'm just going to use this as an example. Let's say that you have a sort of a social network. Maybe it's a local thing or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you have a site where people can sort of share information about themselves. And one of your users, one of the people who uses your site, just got email from a stalker who's made a pretty credible threat of violence or some sort of awfulness. And
sounds awful, but we know this happens.
We know this happens. It happens all too often. Yeah. And so this person needs to shut down basically all of their online presence as soon as possible, right? Because they are going into hiding effectively, which is horrible, but it happens. And how easy do you make it to do that? That's an example of a stress case that almost any site can deal with. Or, you know, if you're selling something, you don't know when somebody really needs to make a purchase in the next 10 minutes or, you know, they're going to be fired, let's say, because they were supposed to do it and it didn't happen and they've got a boss who's not very understanding. And yeah, that job sucks and maybe they should find a new one. But, you know, we're not here to judge, right? Yeah. Their life choices. It's more, you know, I got to get this done right now or else there's going to be severe consequences that it's a crisis. It's maybe not a life or death crisis, but it feels like it. Any crisis that you're in, any like major stress can feel very life or death. And so, you know, how does the site help or hinder those people? And that's what the talk is about. It's weird because, yeah, for 20 years I wrote about markup and CSS, not 15 years for the CSS more or less, but you know, just sort of the technical stuff, like explaining here's how this thing works so that you people who can do design can go do it, right? If you want to create this kind of a layout, here's how you do that. And if you want to create this kind of a visual effect, here's how you do that. And that's what I did, because I'm much more of a developer than a designer. And now I'm doing a talk about design. There's like a tiny bit of CSS and JavaScript at the end, but it's not the point. It's not like I'm saying, and you know, I'm not doing this talk to say, and that means that you use this CSS in this way, and it, you know, will make your designs better. I mean, that's part of it, but it's not the point. And so it's a huge shift for me, and it's been a little bit nerve-wracking to do this talk because I know that I'm way outside of both my comfort zone and for people who know me, it's way outside of what they think of me as providing, like the kind of thing that they come to me for in the past. In the past, they would be, hey, how does this thing work in CSS? And now I'm getting up there and saying, big design problem, and here are some possible solutions. And, you know, here are some bad, you know, here are some examples of how it goes wrong, and here are some examples of how it's done right. And yeah.
Well, I've heard, I haven't, had a chance to see it. I think I'll see it in Boston, though, right?
Yep.
That's good. I'm looking forward to it. What's that?
I can't remember. Dave, you saw it in Atlanta?
I did. If anyone's thinking about going to an event apart, you should go just for this talk. I think what you make very clear is we kind of come... When we design or build a page, we kind of take that ideal scenario. I think you have a stock photography of a woman on a white couch with her Labrador or something, you know, like
the happy path.
Yeah. She's so relaxed. She's going to go to a hospital website or something, you know, and I think, you know, it's actually really eye-opening to think, you know, let's take a worst case scenario, you know, an emergency or a stress or something, duress, like how does that change your website's design? Like do you even have a hero? Like, is that really important? Do you, you know, like, is the phone number the first thing? Is the, you know, what do you, if a user comes, or I even think about it mad, like when I'm mad at Time Warner or something, and I need to talk with somebody. I pay bunches of money for internet a month and I need it to be up right now. You know, that I'm just, and none of the design in the site reflects that ethos. And I think it's a very, it's such a good talk. It really changes the way you kind of think about like what's important in web design.
Wow. Well, thanks. Yeah. So there you go, Chris. There's a preview.
Nice, nice. Yeah, transcends hospital design, right?
Yeah. I don't spend the whole time busting on hospital websites. That's the first like 20 minutes. And it's not even busting. It's more like setting up the situation to say, okay, like try to put yourself in this place that I was to the extent that you can. And then here are the barriers that I ran into. And here's how it could have been done better. And then, you know, I talk about other industries and how they can have, you know, people that have done it well, people that have not done it well. And the fact that designing for crisis makes it sound like I'm saying, you know, only design for people who are in crisis, but I actually talk about more than just personal or emotional crisis. I mean, there are other kinds of crisis. There's contextual crisis, there's technical crisis, those sorts of things. And then I do have actually at the end, it's interesting. It goes back to the medical field and yet it's not about medicine per se. But it's a success story. It's a huge success story. I mean, it's almost, I say in the talk, it's stunning, and it really is. I actually gave a much shorter version of this talk to a health care and medical design conference last week in Boston called HX Refactored, where I basically cut out all the parts that weren't about medical, and then I compressed those down because I literally had like 20 minutes. I went a little bit over.
But that's a room full of people that might be able to affect this change in a bigger way.
But what was interesting was that when I showed them the success story, which is about a line of medical imaging equipment, people who have seen Jared Spool speak in the last couple of years have seen him talk about this. I get into some more details, but anyway, I said, okay, so here's an example of it done right. You know, here's what they did, and here are the returns they got, and like, the audience audibly gasped when they saw the change just over 2 years in terms of like efficiencies and right, because they're used to this sort of thing. And so it was interesting. They actually were way more shocked and surprised and impressed by those stats than I think the web people are. So it was kind of an interesting experience to do that. And to see that, but yeah, I could talk about this for hours and hours. I mean, it could be days that I could talk about this, but,
we'll save it for the people that are coming to Boston.
Yeah. Or any of the other shows except San Diego. I won't be in San Diego.
Okay.
For an event apart because of the timing. The scheduled dates, the dates for San Diego were scheduled a long time ago, but it happens to start the day after the first anniversary of Rebecca's death. Oh. And so I talked it over with the team. I said, you know, I can't guarantee that I'll be in any position, like any condition to speak to anybody, let alone get on a stage and talk for an hour after that. And, you know, maybe I could do it, and maybe with, you know, medication, I could do it. But it's probably, you know, it's not, I don't feel like it's worth the risk. And they agreed. So, Rebecca, again, for those who don't know the story, our daughter Rebecca, after her treatment was fine. And she actually had she was totally herself. You couldn't even tell that she was a cancer patient. When we were staying in Philadelphia, we stayed at the Ronald McDonald House for those 2 months. And in the evenings at dinner time, she would be playing with the other kids, and we would meet new families who came in, and we'd be like, this is our daughter, Rebecca. And they'd say, oh, it's nice to meet you, Rebecca. How is your brother or sister? Assuming that she was with us because there was some kid in the hospital who was being treated, not her. So like, she was just totally herself. But in March of 2014, we discovered there was a second tumor and it couldn't be treated and it couldn't be removed. And she died on June 7th, which was her sixth birthday. And so June 7th this year, my wife is Jewish. And so there's a ceremony after a year after a death where you unveil the grave marker. I've never done this myself because I didn't grow up Jewish, and I'm not actually Jewish as it is now, but we're doing that on the 7th. And so That's why I'm not going to be in San Diego, but I will be at the rest of the shows this year because, I mean, it really, this is a talk that I want to give everywhere, and I hope that we'll film it later in the year and be able to release it eventually. But, you know, it's not the same as being there, obviously. And, it's been really, I've already gotten email from people, after I've done this talk really three times now for an event apart, but twice this year, once in Atlanta and once in Seattle. And I've gotten email from people after, each of those shows basically saying, man, it changed how I look at what I do. And these are the things that I'm going to change. And these are the things that I've realized we need to fix, which is really, I mean, that's for someone whose whole, like my whole motivation really has been to share knowledge and help people do what they do better. Like that's pretty amazing to me that to have, I mean, that's just an amazing feeling to say there's a change here, and it, you know, it comes from my experience, and sharing that experience, which is why, that's why I do it. It's in some ways it's because I can't let what we went through be for nothing, right? There's things that I learned there that I think can really improve how we do what we do. Mm-hmm. And so by sharing that it doesn't make it better, but it brings positive out of everything that I went through and my family went through and are still, I mean, anyone who's listening, who's had a death close to them knows that it's, you know, you don't get over it. You get used to it is the line that I've heard. And that's in some ways that's true. And I mean, I think there's some getting over it. It's not like it's not like every day is the same as right after she died. Like that's, you go through that grieving process and then you have a longer, more subtle grieving process that can be drawn out a very long time. But it's, you know, it's, you go through one stage to another, but you know, part of it is getting used to it. It's getting used to the fact that this is how it is. And, you know, she's not coming back, but, we have the memories and I'm trying to build positive out of that. And my wife, Kat, is also building positive out of that. She's very close to launching a charity that will, I don't want to steal too much of what she's doing away from her because this really is her thing. I'm serving mostly as an advisor in some ways, but it's the way to think about it is there's Make-A-Wish, right, which sends families and children who have life-threatening conditions, not just terminal actually, but life-threatening conditions, you can send them on trips or do amazing, you know, these amazing things for them. And where Kat is creating a charity to do that same sort of thing, but after. So after a child has died, to help the family go on basically a healing trip, as it were, to do something afterwards, to have time together, to sort of be together in their new family configuration. There will be more about that in the next couple of months as she launches that. She's registered at our, I mean, she's already registered as a 501c3 or whatever it is. And we're working on the website, of course, because that's what you do. Yeah. And so that's the positive that she wants to, that she's trying to bring out of it.
Well, I was going to say, I feel very grateful that you are very open to share this information, this kind of private stuff that's happened in your life. But I see kind of two things happening. I feel like it's that the old day of honest blogging. I feel like you kind of anchored in that spirit. And then there's been kind of a cascade of positive change. Your kind of critique of Facebook's year in review thing. I mean, that got picked up by major media and just kind of brought awareness to this idea that, hey, not everything is super great all the time, people. So I feel like you're already beginning kind of this positive rollout of change. And I think that's great.
Yeah, that's what we're aiming for. And that whole thing was kind of weird and fascinating at the same time, because I never expected that to go viral. Of course, no one ever does, or almost no one ever does. If I'd expected it to go viral, I would have written the article a little differently. But then again, if I'd written it differently, maybe it wouldn't have gone viral. Those are you know, unresolvable dilemmas. But yeah, that was more, you know, like you said earlier, one of the things that I put in this talk, but that I'm also talking about, that I was talking about with the Facebook thing, the year in review thing, is that design, like, we're really good at optimizing for whatever our default case is in design. Right? So we think about that ideal user in that ideal situation, and we optimize for that to make that as smooth as possible. And that, there's nothing wrong with that. And I'm not saying that we should stop doing that. But what I'm, you know, sort of the point I'm making is that, you know, this goes out, you know, the stuff that we do goes outside of our default cases. And a lot of times we say, you know, someone will say, well, you know, what about somebody who da-da-da? Like, if you go back to accessibility, you know, what about someone who comes to the website and they're blind? Mm-hmm. And people would say, well, that's an edge case. We're designing for the 90%, not the 10%, or the 99%, not the 1%. That's an edge case. But as Evan Futura Prime on Twitter pointed out, you know, said, I thought, very insightfully, when we say edge case, the term is revealing we're defining the edges of what we care about. Like, we're saying, I care this far and no further. And sometimes that, I mean, you have to set a limit somewhere. But stress cases, when you say a stress case is an edge case, you're basically saying, I don't care about people who are under stress and are trying to do this thing that I'm providing or use this service that I'm providing. And those, you know, sometimes those are the people who need it. Right, they don't just want to use your service. For whatever reason, they are in a crisis and they are on your site. They are there because they need to be there, not because they want to be there. And it's a need that transcends, oh my God, I have to have the Apple Watch. Right? It's a need way beyond that. And so, you know, sort of like when Karen McGrain says, you don't get to decide what your users do on mobile. They do. It's, you don't get to decide what your users want to do when they're in crisis. Right? They do. And there are a lot of benefits if you design with these stress cases in mind. Then if you've created something that someone under stress can use, you've created something that really anyone who's not under stress can use and probably enjoy it a lot more. It has some callbacks to mobile first, where, you know, people were saying, like Luke and Karen and other people who've talked about mobile have said, you know, we have these desktop sites that have this tons of information. Then we have these mobile sites that have like six things that people want to do. Why is that not the main site? Why is that not always the site? Those six things that people want to do. It might look prettier when you come on desktop. Like, you might have more stock photography, but, you know, if you're an airline website, like, there's three things people really want to do primarily. And why does your homepage not just have those three things to make that super easy? Mm-hmm. And some, you know, some airlines do get that, some airlines don't. Another example is HipMonk versus Expedia, which is one of the examples I have in my AEA talk, where I just say, look, you know, trying to book a plane flight is awful, except HipMonk is awesome. And you know, someone in crisis could figure this out. I can tell you that with some certainty, as opposed to going through all this stuff. So this whole, like, you know, thinking about people who are under stress, users who are under stress, people who are under stress, it really opens up a whole new way of thinking about design that helps all your users, all the people who come to your site, not just those people. And so Sarah Wachter Becker and I are, sorry, Wachter Becker. Sorry, Sarah. She and I are actually in the late planning stages of a book that will cover, this sort of general topic of not just designing for crisis. Like designing for crisis will be one chapter basically, and it might not even be called that, but it'll be one chapter out of a larger work where we talk about sort of these principles that we would like people to think about, and then have a section on how to integrate how to change your process to take those things into account and to support those kinds of things. And I think it's more important because Sarah and I were actually talking the other day, and she framed this in a way that suddenly it just made so much sense to me, that a lot of the things we're doing now online are very close to us personally. Right? It used to be that going online was, I need to look up information on Wikipedia, or I need to buy a thing from Amazon, or I need to see what the headlines are on CNN. Those are things that are distant from us personally. But when we go on Facebook or Twitter or you blog, those are things that can be and often are very close to us emotionally and personally. And the chances, the stakes go up asymptotically. The closer that something gets to you personally, like the chance of something being harmful or being difficult to use when you're doing something that's very personal, they go way up. And so in some ways, all the easy questions of design are kind of done, in the sense of we've mostly figured out how to sell things to people online. People may come up with innovations, that's totally true. We've figured out how to communicate information, but how to accommodate humanity, like the human experience, because these things are so close to us now, we're not just going online to say, my life is awesome and this awesome thing happened to me. Like, we're going online to say, I lost my job, or, change your relationship status to single after you've been dating, dating for, or, from engaged to single or whatever. And, or in our case, when Rebecca was first in the hospital, we absolutely used Facebook as a replacement for a phone tree, rather than trying to figure out how to set up a phone tree and worry about people getting missed in the phone tree, worrying about, who's going to call who. We just posted stuff to Facebook. It took, a minute to post an update as to what the doctors had told us or what her condition was that morning. And then we were done and we were back with her instead of having to make a bunch of phone calls or whatever. Right. And there's stuff on Facebook. If I go back on my timeline where, I was chronicling the changes in Rebecca's intracranial pressure when we weren't even sure if she would make it out of before she had her, her first of several cranial surgeries, and we didn't even know if she would survive them, where I was telling people what the situation was. I mean, that is, there's raw stuff in there, more raw than the things I put on MeyerWeb. And so now Facebook has On This Day, right? And come August, they might well say, hey, on this day 2 years ago, your daughter was dying. Okay, I know that, but why are you shoving it at me? It's kind of the thing. I could go on this for hours, but right.
It's just, they're doing it. And you can talk about this much more eloquently than I can, but I like the idea that you're saying that e-commerce, for example, is largely licked online. Like, we get it. There's money exchanges. You send me something in the mail, but how we deal with human beings and people online is much less cut and dry. It's much less figured out.
Yeah. And it's a much harder problem. I mean, because Sarah Wachter Becker makes this point about forms. Like, forms are, we're always like, make the form super simple, right? Like, just a real simple label and a field that they can type something in. But we're asking more and more personal things. And humans are messy. Human lives are messy. And she wrote an article at the beginning of the year about, it was called Personal Histories, which I recommend anyone to go look at, where she ran into a situation. She chronicled a situation that my son will now face in the future. She was filling out a form, and it said, it asked, what number child are you of your mother? Okay. Are you the first, the second, the third, the fourth? Mm-hmm. And she was about to write second when she realized, wait, I'm the third. And my son is in the same situation now. He was the third baby to come into our house, but he is now the second child of his mother because his older sister died. But so the point is not, you know, the point is if you need to know this, think about why that might be problematic and then explain why you want it, because it actually makes a difference. If someone's doing some kind of medical history, it might matter one way. And if he's like applying to the FBI and there's a background check, it matters differently, right? Are you asking like what number child of the children who are around now, or what number child who came into my family's life? And it makes a difference depending on why you're asking. And so, right, and it seems like such a simple thing, right? Or to say marital status. Well, do you mean my marital status right now? Or do you mean my marital status in 3 months when my divorce will be final? I'm not getting divorced personally, but you see what I'm saying. You know, or, you know, relationship status. It's like, well, I'm pretty sure I'm breaking up with this person, but at the moment I'm in a relationship. Like, why do you, like, what is the reason you want to know this? Not who are you to ask me, but what's going to be done with this information? Does it matter to what happens later in this process, or does it matter 6 months from now? You know, how many children do you have? Well, if this is a medical intake form and I'm going to be seeing you for years, and I know that my wife is like 2 weeks out from giving birth to a child, like, what should I say? So, yeah, that's.
Do you think there's a future in which those things are figured out, that we understand them as well as we understand e-commerce?
I hope so. And I don't think it will be as simple as you give me money, I ship you a thing. But what Sarah and I are hoping to do is really to start a conversation, to start the idea of people thinking about how do we deal with these kinds of challenges? What are some good ways? And Sarah and I, neither of us think that there will ever be like one right way to do it. Just like there's no one right way to sell things online. Mm-hmm. Like I think we'll have some good practices. There will always be room for someone to say, well, in this situation, like these quote unquote best practices didn't work. We did it this other way and it totally worked for our users, and maybe that will help other people. This is, you know, the book that we're going to write. I mean, we're going to write it. We don't have a publisher yet. We haven't even talked to publishers yet. We will soon, but we're going to write it regardless. I mean, even if every publisher in the world says, no, thank you, we'll just self-publish it because it's too important. You know, like, we want to get this started for people to start thinking about these things. Our goal with the book is not to say, these are problems and here are the solutions and we figured it out for you. There's just no way we can do that. What we can say is, here are the problems and here are ways to approach those problems and think about those problems and put yourself in the right frame of mind to do what designers do best, right? To say, okay, here is a case I need to deal with. How am I going to deal with that? Designers are awesome at that. We want to get people thinking about these cases so they can start doing that. And then, you know, other people can say, you know, we were asking questions about, you know, the number of children in the family. And we realized that that was very time dependent. And so here's how we made it clear why we were asking and what they should say in various situations, you know, whatever that is. Because I'm not a designer, really. I have some design insights because I've been hanging out with web designers for a really long time now. But I am not the kind of person who's going to say, I've had this brilliant insight and it will change the face of web design and visual design because it is so amazing and it solves all, you know, that's not going to be me. I guess I'm doing the developer thing. I'm saying, here's how you deal with these problems. Now go do awesome stuff with these techniques. So it's a very similar kind of thing, but it's not code anymore. It's not me saying type in these specific commands and then this thing happens. It's saying,
right,
here's a way to think about this.
It's different. Great. Different type of science.
That's great. Well, Eric, we know that you have to get out of here, but thank you so much for a wonderful talk. It's great to hear your story and to see, you know, the positive change that's kind of rolling out from your experience. So thank you very much for sharing that with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on and letting me, just, you know, jabber for an hour.
Oh, we love it. You know, we'll do it more often, I hope.
Yeah, that would be awesome. And if you guys have, if there were any Q&A type questions that showed up during the talk that we unfortunately now don't have time for, feel free to send them to me and I'll try to send answers back and we can
definitely
put them
up
somewhere.
And that brings me into my next question. If people aren't following you or giving you money, how can they do that? And then what's one thing you'd like to plug before you go here?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at MeyerWeb, MeyerWeb, which is the same as the MeyerWeb.com, and it's pretty much my default username anywhere. So you can find me on GitHub under MeyerWeb, for example, because I actually do GitHub stuff now. It's frightening. Ooh. If people want to come to an event apart, absolutely, they should do that. We have a number of shows coming up this year. That's sort of the thing that I plug because it's sort of my primarily what I do now. It's the thing that I'm really proud of, and that's where I'm giving this talk, basically at this point. The calendar is such that it's really hard for me to make it to other conferences. I am starting to find someone near the end of the year. But it's not just my talk, obviously. I mean, I am but one of, 12 pretty great speakers, 11 great speakers and me. There's a lot of insights that to be mined there from, design, code, content. It's AEA being multidisciplinary. That's one of the things we really emphasize. So yeah, hopefully people will find that stuff interesting. If there are questions you guys want to shoot me an email, I'll try to answer them, and you guys could put them up on the site or something like that if people have questions they want to ask.
That sounds great. So, thank you very much, and thanks everyone for coming out in the chat room, shop talking. A lot of good conversation going on there, and thanks everyone for following us on Twitter, downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to rate it up 5 stars. That's how people find out about the show. And if you don't like your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs. Get a new job. There's been a lot of good job postings kind of lately. So keep an eye out there. And Chris, do you got anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.